Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. You know, I know the holidays are tough, but this is Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And when you're dealing with sexual addiction, the most important thing to ask yourself is, are you facing life with the right frame of reference? And what do I mean by that? I mean, you can be a victim and hate this illness and wonder why you've been plagued with it. And you can be angry about the trauma you've experienced or the obsessive compulsive behavior. I mean, you can be negative. But we just had Thanksgiving. And I'm here to tell you that is a yearly reminder to be thankful for everything that has come before us, and to turn it around and reframe it and look at things as a real gift and a challenge. And when you do that, you are emotionally mature. You have what I call good emotional IQ. Now, I know you may be saying, oh, yeah, right, Carol. Well, you can say that. You know, you have not had to deal with what I've had to deal with. And you're right. I have not had to deal with the same thing that you've had to deal with. But you don't know that my life hasn't been worse. You don't know that I haven't had more trauma than you. You don't know that I might have had more physical, emotional, or sexual abuse in my life than you've had. That's the bottom line. We don't know what everybody's facing, but it is absolutely up to us to take our life to the next level. And eventually, when you've worked all your 12 steps, and you've gotten really emotionally mature, you can then say, hey, how can I serve? How can I take my life to the next level? How can I make my life better? And how can I bring other people the hope, strength, and recovery that they deserve to have too? And that's what this show's all about. I mean, I am so excited to be interviewing Patricia, and Patricia is a sex and love addict, although she clearly identifies more with being a love addict. And so she attends SLAA, and she's certainly been to Sexual Addictions Anonymous, and she's just been through the ringer trying to figure out what is wrong with her. Why does she have these compulsive behaviors? Why is she looking for external validation? What is it inside of her that has that wounded soul that makes her susceptible to addiction in general? Why does she pick the wrong men? Why has she picked the right men and not necessarily bonded with with him in a way that she knows that she should. So tonight we're going to be talking with her. Hopefully you'll be able to really relate. And I'm going to ask you to do me three favors. First of all, I'm going to ask you to go to my Facebook page under Carol Jurgensen Sheets. That's J-U-E-R-G-E-N-S-E-N. And then Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, or Carol the Coach. And I'm going to ask you to like my sexual addiction page. Okay, that's my first favor. I want you to like that, as it'll keep you posted on what we're going to be talking about in the upcoming weeks and months ahead. Two, I'm going to ask you to go to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And I'm going to ask you to look at the information that I've posted, the blogs that I've written, and hopefully the hope, strength, and recovery that both I and my clients have given to you. You know, we're all in this thing together. And I remember when I first got educated about this, I said to myself, you know, one of the things I know is that I don't know what I need to know. And this is a learning process. And so, bless my clients' hearts. But they hung in there with me while I learned and they learned. And they had things to teach me and I had things to teach them. And wow, now I've got about 5 or 6 years recovery work in that I have been working with sex addicts for 5 or 6 years. And what I know is that there's still lots that I don't know, but I do know that I do know. I know what it takes to get healthy. I know what it takes to get recovered. I know what those tools are. I really trust my intuition. You've heard me say it before. We're guided by what our heads think, our intellect, what our hearts feel, that's our emotions, and what we intuitively know to be right. And so when I intuitively get a response, a feeling, a reaction that maybe goes against what my clients are saying, I pay attention to it. Because one thing I do know about people that are struggling with this disease is they can't help but have difficulty telling the truth. You know, tonight I talked with a man about the need for rigorous honesty. He was telling me that he had transferred money from one account to the next in order to buy some things for his business, but he would pay it back within 24 to 48 hours. Therefore, he chose not to tell his wife. Now, this has been a sore spot for his wife, who doesn't trust him anyway. And the one thing she's asking from him is for him to be honest. Okay, so here he is. He's not being honest. He's hiding information from her temporarily because he believes that he will be able to get what he needs and wants without worrying her or without causing any conflict. And I reminded him, I said, Don, you're not being honest. You're not being forthright. And this program that you're working requires that you talk about things anyway, even if it's going to bring about conflict. You see, this man is working on his sexual addiction. But when you work on your sexual addiction, you work on increasing the integrity within yourself. And when you feel good about you, when you know that you're being rigorously honest, when you deal with somebody's conflict and you can say to yourself, you know what, I'd rather have that person mad at me than keep it from him or her, then you're on the road to true integrity and recovery. And that is really what life's about. And let's face it, in a normal relationship, we have lots of reasons to lie to our husbands or our wives. You know, I remember talking to my mother-in-law who said, yeah, I buy what I need to, and I just avoid the conflict by keeping it in the trunk and bringing it out when he's gone. You know, it's my money. It means nothing. It just avoids a big old headache and a lot less hassle. And I knew that that was a choice she was making because she feared conflict. She feared having her husband maybe tell her she's spending too much money. I think that we as women who do retail therapy, I myself included, we can say that it's our money and we don't need to have somebody tell us what to do with it. But in essence, if you don't have a buy-in from your partner, from your husband or your wife, it's a problem. You got to figure out how to have a negotiation and a compromise in a relationship to really feel good about that relationship. And so I'm going to ask you, what is it that you're keeping from somebody that you love? And then what I'm really going to do is I'm going to encourage you to share with that person your true feelings. And when you share with that person how you're feeling, what you're doing, what you want, what you need, you'll feel very good about the fact that in healthy relationships, conflict breeds intimacy. And you should be able to share any kind of information, and I'm not saying it'll be smooth sailing, but I definitely believe that you'll feel better about who you are and how you feel about things. So intuitively, you may know, oh, this is, if I may be so bold, shit's going to hit the fan. But at the same time, you know that you're not hiding anything. You know, sexual addiction is about secrets, and you want to get away from that. Now, I got to tell you, I've got a special gratitude for my fellow listeners in Houston. Hey, Houston, I so appreciate you listening to the show. I just recently referred a couple to Dr. Milt Magnus so that they could do an intensive couples workshop. And Milt has each one of them go to an SAA, or COSA meeting during the time to get the support that they need. Well, my client goes to his Houston meeting, and he's saying, you know, I'm here because I'm doing an intensive, and I'm from Indianapolis. And two of the guys in the meeting say, Indianapolis? Hey, you don't know Carol the coach, do you? And my client says, well, yeah, she's the person that sent me here. She's my counselor. And they said, oh, we love her show. We listen to it every week. So, Houston, I am so happy to have you on board with me. And I want you to spread the word. I want this show to take off in ways and directions that it never has. You know, the interesting thing is I have 118,000 downloads a week. That means people at least download the show and they open it. And who knows how much they listen to it, but once it's been downloaded and opened, I get the statistics. Well, interestingly enough, my own posse, my own Indianapolis clients, yeah, they check it once or twice a month. You know, it's no big deal. And they go, we've got you full time. And I'm like, would you please listen to the show? I am interviewing the experts, expert authors, expert clinicians, expert residential treatment centers, expert workshop facilitators. I am so pleased to be part of a group that just has absolutely the best information to give to you. And so, would you ask other people to listen to the show? I would really appreciate that. And, of course, you can download it on iTunes by putting in Carol the Coach or Sexual Addiction and then getting all the shows I've ever done. Oh, that's over 80 of them, I think, maybe even 90. Or you can go to Blog Talk Radio and start downloading the ones that you think are specifically applicable to you. And then, of course, when you do that and you pass the word, it makes me feel good. I know that I'm not wasting a Monday night. I'm contributing to the mental health of sex addicts and their partners everywhere. And love addicts. You know, addiction is addiction, whether it be drugs, alcohol, gambling, eating, working. You know, I probably suffer from that one. They're all the same in that they're compulsive. And there's always a seed of something that doesn't quite feel good enough that contributes to that compulsivity. So I'm going to ask yourself, what is it that just is not working for you? And did it start in childhood? Did it start as a teen? What is it? And that, of course, is part of really looking at what it is that you need to heal in your life. And when you figure that out, you've done half the work. Hey, listen, feel free to call me at 646-595-3284. I'm more than happy to help you. And we'll be back with more Carol the Coach in just one moment.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on.
I have Russell on the line, and I just thought that I would be talking with you instead. You know, I got to tell you, you can call me if you have any questions, and that number is 646-595-3284, or you can feel free to email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. And, you know, I know a lot of people, they're kind of nervous about talking on air. They're afraid somebody will recognize their voice. And when that happens, a good time to just send me an email and, you know, ask the question that you really want to ask. Can you hear my puppy in the background? That doggone dog, he has to be with me. He has to be sitting with me. He just decided right now he was going to take off and have some fun. So what can I say? He is a puppy that keeps me going. You have something that loves you unconditionally? You know, that is so important that you do, because we all need safe, unconditional love. And I really believe that when you have that, just feel part of your soul that can make you feel really much better about yourself. And that can be difficult. You know, trying to figure out how to make yourself feel better can be very tough. And yet, finding something that you love to do, finding something that makes life much, much better for you, all those things are important in setting up your life so that you can feel fulfilled. You know, so oftentimes sex addicts don't feel fulfilled. You know, they feel like something's missing. can be really difficult to ascertain what you can do to make your life feel better. And that's one of the reasons that I really encourage you to reach out to other people. Add a guy tonight, and he's not particularly doing his recovery tools. And I know that he needs to really work diligently at increasing his recovery so that he'll feel more success and he'll feel better about himself. And what did I have him do in group? Well, I asked him if he would bring that recovery tool point list to the rest of the group. Well, actually, I asked him to bring it to three members in particular, and then all my group said, hey, we'd like to see that too. And that's going to make him feel good about himself, that he's actually helping and making a difference in our group. Now, what are you doing for recovery? That's what I want to know. What are you doing to make your life better? What are you doing to make other people's life better? You know, it's important to be able to feel good about that. And so I cannot highly speak enough about what that would look like to know that you're contributing to the life of others. I had a really interesting blog that came to me, and it was X is for X-Rated. And it was from Zach Brittle, who's a licensed mental health therapist. And he said, you know, I have a beef with people who believe that when it comes to addiction, there are a lot of myths. He said, you know, one of the things I know about looking at pornography is that most pornography is based on the idea of physical and sexual perfection. You know, women are stereotypically idealistic in their proportions. They don't have blemishes or wrinkles or love handles. Sex has to do with multiple orgasms. Nobody sneezes, burps, or farts. Sex is never awkward or uncomfortable. It's perfect. He's perfect. She's perfect. And it's a lie. So the myth of perfection prevails in pornography, but it is not real. And then he says, there's a myth of ease. And that myth of ease is that one of the most tragic myths of pornography is that sex is easy. Pornographic sex exists in a world without needy children or ringing phones or football games that will be over in just 10 minutes. Sex is never postponed by fatigue or illness. It's never rejected. Initiation is just a single process. And lo and behold, it's a world where you can sleep with anybody you want without discretion or consequence. There's no fear of rejection and no resistance or irritation. It's easy and it's lie. So this is a guy who gets how porn is such a fantasy that it does nothing but instill a reality that is not real. He goes on to talk about the fact that it's a myth of escape. We know that. I mean, so many of the men that women that I've worked with, they get involved in porn and hours go by. And they have no idea that they've been looking at pornography for the amount of time that they have. And you know, what that means is that there's a great deal of what we call time distortion. This man says, you know, I often hear clients describe their use of pornography as an escape from the norm. way to spice it up a bit or to get some relief from the mundane. This narrow view clouds the reality that a temporary escape from the real world can actually lead into a more permanent, less healthy attachment. Isn't that the truth? You know, the typical narrative of pornographic sex is pretty simple. Strangers meet, they have sex, and never see each other again. Well, let's face it, relationships are much more complicated than that. And so porn makes relationships look so different than what they really are. And, you know, I can remember when I was single and Arvo Hendricks said, you know, you don't really grow unless you're in a relationship or married. And I thought, now that's offensive and insulting. And what I meant by that was that clearly you can grow if you're single. There's no reason to think that you can't. What Harville really meant, and he's a great therapist, and he wrote Being the Love You Want and Finding the Love You Seek. And those are both different manuals. One is for the married person and one is for the single person. And what he really meant by all that is that if you really want to learn about yourself, if you really want to work on power struggling, most of us grew up either not getting our needs met or getting our needs met and wishing that our needs were met differently. And he says, you know, what do? We attract that same kind of partner into our life. This time as an adult, it gives us a chance to get it right. And that's why being in a committed relationship, despite the fact that it's really, really tough, it increases the opportunity to grow. And that is so important. Now, clearly, there are lots of different myths to porn. And problems arise when porn users become more attached to the pattern their pornography and to the person they're committed to having sex with. Yeah. That attachment bonds the user to a fetish of impersonal sex and unhealthy relationships. It leads them away from a personal relationship and back into pornography. It creates compulsion and overuse. And it's a lie. So, interestingly enough, he came up with one other major myth, and that's of privacy. He says many users justify their porn use as no big deal because it doesn't affect anybody else. It doesn't hurt anybody. That's pretty naive. In addition to the myths discussed above, all of which have implications for others, we now live in a world where everything is interconnected, and it's virtually impossible to assume that your private behavior has no public impact. You know, porn use is a gateway to sexual escalation. And what that means is that it's very hard to have a private, intimate relationship when you're living a life of porn. Does that make sense? So, don't think that if you have compulsive use of porn, that it's not affecting you. It's affecting your reality and it's affecting your ability to have relationships. Now, we CSATs get a bad rap because so many people say to us, you know, oh, you're anti-porn. And truly, most of us CSATs know that there are plenty of people that can use porn and it enhances their relationship with others. Plenty of people. For addicts, porn has been taken to a different level. And addicts can't look at porn. And it has allowed them an opportunity to escape into a world that isn't real. And it contributes to isolation and all sorts of other triggers that make porn use auto-exacerbating. Now, what I mean by that, because I know that's kind of a big word, but, you know, when I ask you, what are your triggers? What triggers you into voyeurism or exhibitionism or pornography? What triggers you into the kinds of issues that contribute to your porn use? Well, interestingly enough, what I know to be true is that we all have triggers. Some are stress. Some are isolation. If you're feeling stressed or isolated, I want you to call 646-595-3284. And we can talk about the situation at hand. And we can talk more about what is it that contributes to your triggers and to your stress. Now, I've got Patricia on the line, and Patricia is going to talk a little bit about her life and what has happened to her. So, Patricia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol.
How are you?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Can you hear me okay?
Okay. Yes, I can.
Okay. So, tell me a little bit about yourself in that. Would you consider yourself a love addict or a sex addict?
Well, when I came to SLA, I've been in the program for 6 years. I consider myself more like a sex addict. And as my recovery evolved, I'm starting to kind of work more on the love addiction, you know, sort of like my compulsivity and bottom lines. I've been able to keep my sex bottom lines, and it's more like my love addiction and codependence. There are more difficult to manage in a way.
Well, I know, because initially you really thought of yourself as a sex addict, and when you went to your first meeting, you were with all men. Is that correct?
Yes, pretty much. I went to SA my first meetings, and then I found out about this woman's meeting, and you know, for sex and love addiction. I felt a little triggered to be, you know, in a room full of men, so I also kind of like was looking for a women's meeting, but there was only like mixed meetings for SA. And then I found SLA, and I started kind of like realizing that love addiction was also pretty, you know, a big problem for me.
Yeah, and so one of the things as I was reading your biography, I realized that you felt very uncomfortable. You felt very triggered by being in a room of men, in part because you had really used men before to kind of validate you, and you knew that that wasn't a healthy choice. Is that correct?
Yeah, right. Pretty much, you know, my patterns were very, you know, destructive. I had a pattern of anonymous sex, you know, and contacting men through websites and meeting them. You know, I put myself at risk of, you know, contracting diseases, being attacked by people that I didn't know, all sorts of things. My disease was completely, you know, in control of everything that I was doing, and I had no common sense. You know, I was completely and entirely involved in the addiction, and I couldn't think and rationally, you know, obviously. So Yeah, that's what's happened. And, you know, after I started coming to SLA, I got a sponsor, and I stopped, you know, I put down some bottom lines, but I had a couple of relapses, and, you know, but for the most part, I'm sober on my main bottom lines for over 6 years now.
Yeah, and what I really admired about your biography is that you talked about the fact that, yes, you have been sober from your bottom line behavior for six
mm-hmm.
years, but you have had slips, you've had some relapses, you haven't done the program perfectly, but you're making headway, you're doing really well, and you're contributing in lots of different ways. And so you kind of have to stay focused on the positive, don't you, when you're dealing with addiction?
Right. I'm pretty aware that I, you know, that my recovery has been, you know, pretty substantial, and that, you know, like I'm really grateful to everyone in the rooms, and, you know, I have really good friends now. I didn't have women friends before, or very little, you know, and now I have a lot of women friends. I have a lot of support. You know, and now I'm kind of realizing that I have to rebuild my relationships with men. You know, I haven't been, you know, I've been sober dating, but, you know, I kind of, you know, I'm still like in the early stages of that. So it's easier to recover and be on your own. But then when you have to go dating, which I never did before, it's kind of like, for me, it feels like an alcoholic going to a bar. You know, it's just trying to sober date is really, really hard right now for me. So I don't know.
I was going to ask you to explain to our listening audience, what do you consider to be sober dating?
Okay, well, sober dating is kind of defined through in SLA with a dating plan, and it's kind of like discussed between you and your sponsor what you consider to be, you know, accordingly to your, you know, your issues, you know, your compulsivity and your history, what is kind of like your triggers, you know, so you have an idea of what situations or what type of people trigger you, and you kind of like build your dating plan around, you know, knowing that awareness and sort of like, you know, sex and love addicts normally get attached too soon. They also don't have a very good idea of the type of man or women they're compatible with. And they make rash decisions about partnership, you know, and that's the dating plan normally tells you, you know, you can't, like, get attached to someone until a certain time. You can't have sex with a person until a certain number of months. You know, for me, it's 2 months, and I haven't been very good with that, but it's been better than in the past, obviously. But, you know, it's just like sometimes you can't, like, do everything in that sober plan, but it's kind of an outline of how to date in sobriety. So it's kind of, it's tricky, but, you know,
no,
like,
it sounds like you're describing a dating program that you've set aside for yourself where you know there are some healthy boundaries. It gives you time to really get to know somebody. It gives you time to develop more of an emotional intimacy before you get into the sex intimacy.
Right.
It gives you time to discern whether that person is good for you and whether it's really a smart choice to have sex.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I also have other things, like I can't, you know, normally I can't move with anyone until, like, I know the person for 2 years. For me, that's mm-hmm. a really important bottom line, because I definitely used to sort of like move in with a person or let the person move in with me without knowing that person. And that's, I think love and sex addicts, they think that intensity is intimacy, and it's not. You know, intimacy is built, you know, by knowing someone during a long period of time or a bigger period of time, and not like in the space of a week or two. And sex and love addicts, they think, you know, or especially love addicts, they fantasize, and they sometimes, you know, I hear shares in a room, like people they just met, and they start thinking about having babies or getting married, and, you know, it's just completely like fantasy. So I normally didn't engage so much in fantasy, but I was sort of like very, I would do rush decisions in terms of allowing people to live with me or, you know, I mean, you know, other elements of my personality would contribute to me wanting to rescue men, you know, which is something it's like very, you know, embedded in my love addiction, is just my caretaking towards people that are not able to take care of themselves. And I kind of like...
You gravitate towards that. Now, do you think that you pick those kind of relationships because some trauma that you experienced as a child?
Well, I think, I mean, I thought a long time about that. Actually, you know, recently I read something about it, and I think that it's possible that I do have that compulsion because I grew up in this environment that I sort of like had to emotional caretake of my caregivers, and I felt responsible for their well-being. I felt responsible for them to be together. I felt responsible for them to feel happy together, because they were like sort of fighting all the time, or they were not talking, and I would be like the person in the middle, the child in the middle that would make them happy. So I feel, I don't know, I don't really know how to be in a relationship. I'm still, even after 6 years of recovery, I'm finding that I have a really hard time being in a relationship and putting the same level of energy that the person, you know, managing like the same levels of energy. I always give more than I receive. And I feel like that's, you know, in the past I felt like that's the right way to do it. And I feel like it's like not right now. It's not working for me. So I need to address
that. Well,
you know,
as I looked at your biography again, obviously Patrick Carnes talks about the fact that sometimes worse than abuse is that parental neglect that so many sex addicts have experienced, either
mm-hmm.
because they had a parent that had a drug or alcohol problem, or they were just emotionally unavailable. And your mom was definitely emotionally unavailable and basically just abandoned and left you with your grandparents.
Exactly. Yeah. And my grandparents, they were also like in their own world. You know, they were like not available for a child, you know, to take care of a child, really. I mean, they, you know, sometimes for me, I grew up in an environment that all my, you know, basic needs were met. You know, that sometimes people that have neglect, it's more obvious. So for me, it took me a while to recognize the abuse, because I really had all the basic needs met, but I didn't have the emotional needs met, and I only came to realize that later, you know. So,
well, and you know, basically when kids are very young and they're not getting their needs met, they grow up with the question mark of what can I do to make my parent or parents happy? Well, how can
mm-hmm.
I contribute to their life so that I find meaning? And certainly one of the things that I noted about your childhood is that people were unavailable for you. And so mm-hmm. I wonder if it fed into your needing to be codependent in your relationships with men, you know, where you put your needs on the back burner and you met their needs and you were into pleasing them and being perfect for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think I also attract a kind of energy. I always attract these men that are very needy, and they, you know, sort of like need a lot of help with different things. You know, sometimes they could be even like good professionally, they could be okay, but then emotionally they're very needy, and they kind of like, they give me extra power to like, and allow them to allow me to caretake them, you know. And then I feel like sometimes I even feel like that's the center of the relationship, and then I become resentful about it. So it's kind of like I notice it's a kind of a pattern that I developed, and mm-hmm. and it's just like, it's a really here. I mean, I have also, like, from my childhood, I had very negative sexual, you know, like restrictions, you know, like in terms of like the message when I was growing up is that sex was a bad thing, and sex was sort of like, you know, to be avoided almost. You know, I think most people in my family, they were, I mean, I didn't include that on my text to you, but I think most of my family, they were like sexually anorexic, and and sort of like, you know, so like my messages when I was growing up was kind of like completely like, do not talk about sex, do not be sexual, do not show anything, you know. So I kind of like, I guess I came out the other side, you know, with all this addiction.
It makes so much sense that, you know, when I look at your resume, I mean, you're very accomplished, you're very professional, and you put a lot of that energy into being a high achiever in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah.
No, go ahead, sir.
Well, I was going to say, you know, obviously, you've got female friends now. You're going to SLAA groups. And would you let our listening audience know what SLAA stands for?
SLAA is Sex and Love Addicts. In the city that I live, there's actually women-only meetings. So that's a really great thing because, you know, for people that, women that, feel that maybe a room with mixed audience is not a safe place. You know, it's just really great to recover with a women's only meeting. Some SLA meetings are women's only. So there's also like men's only meetings. So I think these kind of subject matters sometimes is better just to be in a room with the same sex or having sponsors with the same sex. I mean, normally, I think that's, would you agree with that, Carol?
Oh, 100%. And, you know, that's what I think is so important is that people need to decide what works for them and what doesn't, because
mm-hmm.
some women don't feel safe in meetings where there are men, and because they just don't feel like they can be honest and real. They fear triggering the men, blah, blah, blah. And then, like you said earlier, some women are actually triggered by men being in their meeting. And they go into old behaviors that they're actually trying to break. And so oftentimes being in a same-sex meeting allows you not to have to deal with that stuff so that you can deal with your specific 12 steps. And the character defects you have, and the making amends, and changing those around, and, you know, giving it up to God, and all that the 12 steps stand for. So I would absolutely agree with you there.
Right. Well, when I started going to women's meeting, and actually now on Thursdays I go to a mixed meeting which is a building healthy relationships meeting, which is, you know, it's not triggering for me anymore. So I, you know, I guess I overcame that. I mean, it's still a little bit, I'm conscious that I'm with men in the room, but I don't feel triggered, you know, like I used to, you know, that I couldn't, like, speak at all. So,
yeah, and sometimes as you get stronger, you realize that it's a good thing to deal with those feelings. Because here's what I believe, Patricia. I believe in my therapy groups and in my individual marital sessions that what happens in the group happens out in the real world. And what happens in the real world oftentimes happens in our sessions. And that's kind of the same with the 12-step group. And so what you're really trying to do is increase your understanding of yourself and healthy behaviors. And so it may be, for some people, that they're not ready to take on all that and they need the safety of a same-sex group. And then for other people, they are ready to kind of take it on and work within a safe environment because hopefully everybody in that group will help you too. Now, I have to admit, I've certainly talked to people that said that a man or a woman came up to them and said, hey, I'd really like your number so that we can keep in touch. Well, those kind of things are inappropriate in meetings, you know, with opposite sex people. It just is the way it is. Would you not agree?
Yeah. I mean, actually, In most meetings, they're mixed. The texts, you know, we read a text that talks about that. It's called thirteen-stepping. You know, the person. You know, so like you, it's discouraged to have any sort of like relationship outside, you know, the friendship or something. It's sometimes, you know, it's complicated. You know, everyone has. You know, even people that have been in recovery for a long time, you know, sometimes, you know, it depends on the fellowship, but especially in SLI, I think it's I wouldn't feel comfortable. I don't have any male friends really in this fellowship. You know, I have acquaintance from the rooms, but I don't really like hang out or sort of like would think of having a sponsor that would be a man. I think for me that wouldn't work. So, I mean, I guess everyone is different, but that's what I think. I don't know.
Now, I want to ask you one more question because I'm sure many of my listeners are wondering, for the men that are listening, they're probably wondering, how did a woman... how is it that a woman became afflicted with this illness, this disorder, this condition? You know, they understand how that could happen to a man, but not a woman. So I want to ask you two things. One is I want to ask you, do you think that your trauma as a child contributed to your sex and love addiction? And then the second thing that I'd like to ask you is do you think you practiced some unhealthy behaviors that somehow got brain locked in your neurochemistry and made it very difficult to get out of?
Yeah, I would answer those questions, yes. Well, you know, basically growing up in a household that was very, you know, how do I say... you know, wouldn't allow a person to express themselves, wouldn't allow, you know, there was, like, opinions, there was no sort of, like, communication, there was no, you know, like, basically the grown-ups were just telling the children how to behave, what to do, what to be, what to feel, you know, it was just like, I grew up, like, all the time being denied my reality, you know, so basically my reality didn't exist. It was always my parents' reality that mattered, and that was, you know, if I had a perception of something, that was denied. Then there was constant criticism, you know. So your level of self-esteem is already really, really low. And then, you know, I tried to please my parents as much as I could until a certain time. And then, you know, you go to high school and boys start noticing you and, you know, and that kind of turns the table because suddenly you're not, you don't want validation. This black hole for validation, you know, gets turned to boys. And then you start having, you know, I didn't become a sex addict in high school, but I became a sex addict in college. You know, the nature of this disease is gradual. So you start, you know, looking for more and more intensity, and I also added intensity with drugs and alcohol. So, you know, it escalates to a point that, you know, you end up by having anonymous sex, you know, 20 years after because your hits need to be higher and higher and higher, you know, and, you know, it's just like a drug. You know, when I was doing drugs, it was the same thing, you know, like whatever amount of drugs I was taking, I had to take more to get the same effect. So it just escalates. You know, I see sex addiction like a drug addiction for me. I don't know, for other people. And so basically, you know, like I didn't have some of, you know, like some of the male behaviors with pornography, but, you know, I was exposed to danger. I was exposed to risk behaviors that a lot of men, you know, somehow, you know, do because of the disease. So I was like completely powerless and I lost control of my life. And, you know, I was distracted at work. I was missing work. I was getting fired from jobs. So my life was unmanageable completely. And it was my sex addiction that was doing that and my drug addiction. You know, I'm sorry, Carol, I lost track. What was the other question you were asking me?
Whether you felt like it was due to the trauma or whether you felt like you created some unhealthy behaviors that almost got brain locked due to neurocircuitry.
Yeah, I mean, I think my trauma of living in a house that sort of like that surrounded by adults that didn't respect me, didn't help me, didn't, you know, I just felt like looking for validation in different places, and you know, like I was saying, it escalated from that moment to my adult, you know, after college, and that I was sort of like became extremely promiscuous, and you know, I just used sex and romance as a drug, basically, to avoid feeling
you know, Patricia,
feeling so bad about myself.
You have been so enlightening and so honest and forthright, and I so appreciate you explaining this condition and you just kind of began to touch on how this came to be. I would love to interview you again in the future. Unfortunately, our time is up. But
okay.
I just want to say thank you because you really
thank
contributed
you,
to the well-being of our listeners. Thank you so much.
Yeah, can I just say one word? Is that I'm really, really grateful to SLA, and I want to tell everyone that the program really works. If you work the steps, you get a sponsor, and you practice the program. I mean, I have a DNA change. I mean, I feel like I'm a total different person. I have, you know, I recovered everything that was mine, you know, and I can tell,
and I absolutely can tell. So let me tell you, Patricia, we have to end, but thank you, and let's do this again soon. You're listening to Sex Help with Carol the Coach. We'll see you next week.